Welcome back to Camera Conversations with your host Colin Campbell, and today is episode 213 of the podcast, and I'm joined in conversation by Stephen Arena, who is better known online as Really Tan Man. In this episode, you can expect to learn what drove Stephen to explore the food system and the mission he's on now to share some challenging information about what is going wrong in the modern food system. I ask about Stephen's experience with exploring alternative options, diets, sources, and the battle that he's raging against seed oils to try and support people when it comes to battling back against the modern food system and improving on people's health. My own curiosity in this space was really flagged when I started to look into some of the issues that were caused by common seed oils, in particular soybean oil, and it's linked to inflammatory bowel disease and leaky gut. There's an awful lot that we can do from an individual perspective to support where our food comes from and how it's made. And one of my favorite parts of this conversation that is away from that kind of food side of things is how Stephen has been able to build a business and leave a highly paid job to pursue something that he cares deeply about as well. And I think anyone that's got an entrepreneurial hat on will be very interested in how Stephen's been able to do that and has plans to scale his product and his business in this space. We got incredible feedback on a recent episode with Dr. James McElroy when we were talking about the gut and the microbiome, and I intend on doing some more episodes in this space to really delve into specific diet and food recommendations and actions that you can take to improve your gut health and your overall health in the near future. Today's podcast is sponsored and supported not by one of my usual sponsors, but by my upcoming podcast masterclass course. The vast majority of podcasts fail. The odds are stacked against you. 80% stop before hitting episode 8, and then hundreds of thousands more drop off before episode 24. The benefits and opportunities that I've opened up to myself over the last 3.5 years through podcasting have been incredible, whether that's from a business perspective, a personal brand perspective, network perspective, and even building authority in a space that I care about in self-development. Building a podcast opens so many doors, and it could be you. I've learned so much from building the podcast to the top 1% globally, and I've distilled all this experience down into a simple to follow 9-module video course, which includes information about software and equipment, of course it does, but it also delves into guest management, research, how to build out your pipeline, and even my secrets to research and preparing for interviews and distributing and marketing it to the widest possible audience. It's due for release in just 7 days' time, but if you are listening to this before then, please do DM me on Instagram or LinkedIn the word masterclass, and I will give you access to the early bird discounted offer. Now, that's quite enough for me in this introduction. I think we're going to go really deep on all things the modern food system with Stephen in the next hour and 10 minutes. I hope you're all enjoying it. If you are new here, please hit the subscribe or follow button or whatever app you're on. And if you're using Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please do navigate your finger or your thumb to the 5-star rating button. It's a massive help for the show, and it's helped it grow into that top 1% bracket, which I'm really keen for us to keep pushing on with. Stephen, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me.
Great to be here. Thanks, Colin.
And when I was getting into the research about who the Really Tan Man is online, who Stephen is, it took me a wee while to find your actual name was Stephen as well, because your branding is so strong these days.
Yeah. It's the character, the Really Tan Man, the Masa, like that stuff is the important stuff, like the personal stuff. I don't know, it tends to be less of a compelling brand, I think, at least at this stage, for like the way the social media is working out for us.
Yeah, and I think your social media journey's been really quick. If you look at the time scales that you built your audience on TikTok, you built your audience on Instagram and Twitter, it's all happened relatively quickly. Yeah. If you came across you now, you're like, oh, he's really established. But I mean, what are we talking, 18 months, 2 years of really consistent posting?
Yeah, so I started TikTok. TikTok is how I got started. I was working as a software engineer at the time, and this was during the height of work from home during COVID. And so big tech software jobs at that time meant you work basically like 5 to 10 hours a week. I was probably a little lower than average, I will say, but I don't know what it is today after all the layoffs and stuff. But yeah, I was basically working 5 hours a week, and I had a lot of spare time. And so I decided to start making TikToks about all the health stuff that I had learned over the years. And I got to 80,000 followers on TikTok in about 80 days from doing TikToks like every single day. And then making TikToks seemed to be a bit too time consuming for me. Video editing and all that whole production process is not like what I really enjoy spending my time doing. And so I switched to Instagram and then Twitter. And so I started my Instagram around the same time, but I started Twitter in the beginning of 2022. So it's been about a year and a half since I've been on Twitter. And I think it's been a long time since I posted anything on TikTok. But yeah, basically the social media stuff sort of transitioned, especially after I figured out Masa and Ancient Crunch and started spending more time on that. And so I spent a lot less time doing really Tan Man stuff, and much more of my time is spent on the actual business.
As the entrepreneur rather than necessarily the educator?
Yes, yes, for sure. It's a good way to put it.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting differential, isn't it? Because I think sometimes for you to gain the authority to go and create a business in the space that you have created it in, it helps that you have the authority of knowledge and the education that you've been sharing around health for such a long period of time.
Not only is it the authority, but also just like the audience itself. So when I launched Masa, the product, which if people aren't familiar, it's tallow fried organic corn tortilla chips. So no seed oils is the primary pitch relevant to like modern trends. But it's not just about the seed oils. It's basically just like real food is pretty much it. Everything that comes in a package is fake in one or more ways, even if it's like a quote unquote health food. And if you want to get into that, we can talk about all the ways that health food is like a scam. But really what it is just actual food put in a package. So like people have this idea that packaged food is bad for them. Well, it doesn't have to be, you know? And so we're showing what it's like to have packaged food that's not bad for you. And that the authority was helpful, but also like when going to launch that, I already had, you know, I don't know, 15, maybe 10,000 Instagram followers, like 15,000 Twitter followers. And also a bunch of, because I had that audience, there were other micro influencers in the space that I just become acquaintances with. And so they were our early affiliates. And so it was easier to like the go-to-market strategy was like kind of cut out for us already because of the social media experience. I do think the authority plays a role in it as well. But I would argue that the thing that was the most explicitly useful was my own audience and my access to other people's audiences who I was like acquaintances with.
Yeah, a term that I've been learning a lot about recently from some recent guests has been distribution. And you had a network to distribute your ideas to, but more importantly, you then had an audience to distribute your products to as well. And they were aligned within your niche as well, because by following the information you were putting out, they were predisposed to be interested in a product which solved some of the pain points that they maybe had in terms of getting foods that resonated with their idea of health or their idea of like what they want to eat.
If you're a Tan Man follower, then Masa chips are something that you're interested in almost like 100% of the time. So that was helpful. And I think I would like to have more time and content, more time to spend on producing content or more people to help me make the content. But there's just so much going on at the stage that we're in right now that it's like not the highest priority. But I would say probably in about 6 months to a year, I'll be focusing a lot more on the really Tan Man like content platform itself, and grow that adjacent to Masa, because that helps significantly. But it only does so much. It's one of those things where like it has a high payoff over the long term, but it takes a long time to get there. And so, you know, based on the constraints on time and budget at the present moment, it's not necessarily the best use of time.
The priority principle is essential, and sometimes it's hard to pull yourself away from maybe the stuff that makes you feel good. But obviously, if you're creating a business that you care about, that feels good too. But I want to go back before the really Tan Man and understand when you first started to show an interest in the food going in your mouth and how it dictates your health off the back of it.
So that was about 10 years ago. At this point, that was in almost 10 years ago, 2014, after my freshman year of college. I actually did a sort of study abroad thing in Europe. I was in Belgium at some like research neuroscience lab, and I had to cook for myself for the first time ever, because in the US, prior to college, my mom cooked everything I ever ate. And then at college, we have dining halls. And at least in Belgium, I think the UK college system might be a bit different. But at least in continental Europe, like universities don't have dining halls. Like you're out there fending for yourself. And so by being forced to cook for myself for the first time, it was sort of this like vertically integrated process. You know, previously I was just the consumer of food that I ate, but like at that time I had to become the producer of food that I ate and the consumer of it. So like having the vertical integration meant that I could like see how food that I purchased and cooked and then ate affected how I felt. And so I was just poking around on the internet, discovered that like diets existed. I think the paleo diet was popular at the time. And, you know, I had no idea about any of this. And I was like, I should, you know, check this out. Healthy food. That sounds reasonable. And then I did it. And then within 2 weeks, like a lot of health problems that I'd had prior sort of went away. And that's that was like the light bulb moment where I was like, oh, wow, you know, we really are what we eat. And if I want to like have a, you know, better life, then it starts with like your literal physical constitution, which comes from the food that you eat. And that sort of set me down the, you know, multi-year long rabbit hole of interest that ultimately led to where we are today. But yeah, so I went back to school and was doing all the cooking, following all the trends, brewing kombucha, making sourdough bread in my dorm, you know, in my dorm room kitchen, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was like the passion that never really left me. And it also taught me the whole, like, it's kind of like, you know, like fatalism where, you know, people are like, oh, I'm sick. Like they just give up and they're like, oh, they accept the circumstance of their life. And they're like, oh, I'm a
nihilistic.
Yeah. Outlook. And they're like, I'm a person who is bloated or I'm just fat or I get sick all the time. Like that's who I am. Like figuring out how to change that, like gives you the mindset that your life circumstances are subject to change in other ways too, not just about health. And that idea is like, it's same thing with money. It's like, oh, I'm just poor or I just have a job or I'm just a wage slave, as people like to say. But like you have control over all these things. It might not be easy to do, but with like, you know, the right effort applied in the correct direction over time, like you can change pretty much anything. So I think that's where the entrepreneurial thing and the food thing are sort of go hand in hand in this way.
There's a huge amount of empowerment to understanding that your daily actions add up to where you end up. Like your habits a year ago have a lag effect on where you are now. And you can kind of predict that based off that. And I think food is a huge indicator of that. If you look at modern society where we are more overweight, more obese, if you look at the UK, if you look at the US, like we have a significant trend of people becoming heavier and less healthy over time and a number of different diseases that are, of course, heavily linked to obesity as well.
Yeah, it's like, it's kind of like a responsibility thing. It like teaches you that you're responsible for the outcomes in your life. And people like to point to some other third party that's responsible for their problems. And a lot of the times this is like everyone's political ideology basically is formed by who they're blaming their problems on, right? If you blame it on the government, you blame it on companies or corporations, you blame it on, you know, people, whatever. Everyone's trying to blame their problems on someone else. But I think the key, the important lesson is even if other people or other like third parties do have something to do with your problems, it doesn't really help you to blame them because that doesn't allow you to change anything. Even if like you can level blame at some other entity, acting as if you are entirely to blame for all of your circumstances is the only way to ever really change them.
One of the most popular creators at the moment is Jocko Willink, and he's massive on personal responsibility, isn't he? And just that complete and utter ownership of the situation that you're in.
I've heard of him. I'm not too familiar with him, but that sounds about right. Yeah, like it's kind of like the same thing with health too. People are like, oh, but I have a slow metabolism. Like it's like an excuse for being fat, or, oh, I have this disease, or I have, you know, I don't know, my hormones are different. Well, it's like, even if that's true, that doesn't help you because you're still going to be fat. You know, all it does, it's like, it's a little like mental medication. Like it's a mental painkiller because as long as you can blame someone else, you'll feel, at least in the moment, you'll feel good about it because, you know, you're not at fault. But it's a very useless way of thinking because again, it still results in you being fat. So even if you do have some metabolic condition, or even if you do have whatever diabetes or whatever people are blaming their excuses on, even if you do have it, pretending as if you don't have that and everything is in your control is the only way that you're ever going to change your situation.
Of course. Yeah. If you just accept your fate, then that's what's going to transpire. So paleo was one of the first things that you looked at. You noticed that you saw some immediate health benefits. Yeah. You were the guy that was baking his own sourdough dough bread as well, which is a cool kombucha as well. And how has that progressed to perhaps the lifestyle that you live now? Let's fill in some of those gaps.
Yeah. So I think the ultimate end point where I have found and where many people also have found over the years is that you just should eat real food. Like that's it. Like traditional food, you could call this ancestral eating or the ancestral diet or something, but it's like, it's very simple. If your great, great, great grandparents didn't eat this thing, then probably you shouldn't either. You know, if they didn't have access to it, it was invented in the past 100 years since the Industrial Revolution, most likely incompatible with human biology. And this carries over also into like sort of traditional eating. For example, like some people, yeah, like if you lived in the Philippines or Hawaii, like 200 years ago, you had access to coconut oil, for example. But most people, I'm sure, who are listening to this podcast do not have ancestry from the Philippines or Hawaii. And so it's like, if your ancestors never ate coconut oil, like, just think about it. You know, I'm not saying coconut oil is bad, but it's like, just think about it, you know? Like, is there a relationship between our biology and the foods that, like, our ancestors ate that's, like, beneficial, such that foods outside of what they ate might be somewhat incompatible? Certainly not as bad as the sort of toxic process, like chemistry, lab experiment stuff. However, yeah, the ultimate idea is, like, you don't need to restrict what you eat based on a gluten-free or a paleo or this or that. Simply just eat your food, but make sure that it's real food. So that means if you're going to eat French fries, make sure the potatoes don't have pesticides in them, and make sure that they're deep fried in tallow and not seed oils, and make sure the tallow is grass-fed and whatnot. If you're going to have bread, make sure it's sourdough bread with organic wheat of like a, you know, a heritage variety of grain that was freshly milled. You can make any food that you want, like with real food, with real ingredients. And if you do that, you're going to be okay. I think there's a little bit of an extremeness that people adopt. And I'm not saying that certain extreme diets don't have their therapeutic like use cases, like keto can cure people of, like, if they have epilepsy or whatever. That's like when the keto diet was invented, was in the 1920s, like by doctors trying to treat epilepsy, for example. However, people were healthy before crazy diets existed. That's like the key thing to understand. Prior to the 1970s, when diet culture really became popular in America, people were healthy and they didn't, you know, avoid gluten, and they didn't avoid carbs, or they didn't avoid meat, or they didn't avoid vegetables, or whatever, you know, restrictive diet that's a modern thing that you want to think of. They didn't do any of that. And your great granddad was like way healthier than you are. No matter, even just, and like, despite the fact that he didn't have a gym membership and he didn't do CrossFit 5 times a week and he didn't like eat crazy food, he's still, and he like smoked half pack cigarettes a day or had a pipe or something, he was still healthier than you are. Like, why is that, right?
That is one of the standout pieces of content that you share, Stephen, is when you maybe share like photos from a beach in 1940 or 1950. And on the whole, there are very few visibly obese people. Now, while life expectancy has increased over time, but that's perhaps, you could argue, down to some of the modern medicine that we have, or modern healthcare has become more sanitized, etc., and hospital treatments become more successful, you could argue. But we are putting more of a strain on healthcare and medical than ever before, and we're more overweight. And if you took a photo of a beach nowadays, it would look significantly different to that period
also,
of time.
Also, the thing about life expectancy is a fun one, because, well, first of all, life expectancy, at least in America today, is like decreasing. Like, our life expectancy now is like worse than it was 5 years ago. So like, we're not headed in a good direction. And obviously, because you're measuring when people die at the end of their life, there's like a lagging, it's like life expectancy is a lagging indicator. So there is that component to it. But the other thing about life expectancy that I don't find to be particularly compelling metric is, like, what's better, right? 80 years of obesity and like a life, an 80 year life of obesity and pills, or a 70 year life of being fit, you know, and like active? What's better? So
yeah, there's no argument from me there at all. I can completely agree with that. But even if we look at the conditions we live in modern times, if we do look after our health, we should be able to living beyond the people who are 80 and on all sorts of medication.
What I'm just trying to get at is, like, people who will say, oh, but we're so, you know, our life expectancy in America is so high. Like, the medical system can basically keep you barely alive for 75 years. And somehow that's better than, you know, 70 years ago when people were thriving for, you know, 5 fewer years on average. Of course, average life expectancy also takes into account, you know, injuries, illnesses, especially like childbirth issues, especially if like kids are dying young, like with typhoid fever and all this stuff. And there's reasons for all that, which we could talk about too. But people on the whole were living, like they spent most of their lifetimes living a better life than we do today, even if we live 5 or 10 years longer. So like, what's better about this? Like, why is it better to have a country of fat people, you know, barely alive for 80 years than it is to have a country of like fit, healthy people that may die 5 years earlier? Even though I don't think that's the case, because obviously if you're that healthy, you're going to live longer. But if we're comparing the present history, that's what the data might suggest is the comparison. Certainly the number of years of quality life is the thing to be optimizing for.
Yeah, exactly that. You would much rather a higher quality of life than just for the sake of longevity. Yeah. And that's why sometimes you see some longevity experts online who live this very bizarre existence. You think, well, yeah, okay, maybe it's not for me with like, an 8-hour morning routine. But one of the things that I'm really keen to ask is, you've used the term industrial revolution as maybe a tipping point for when the food system started to change in a way that you believe has been like incredibly detrimental for health, and it's resulting in a lot of these outcomes. What are some of the changes that happened that have caused these challenges? Yeah.
So the big difference before and after the Industrial Revolution is that before the Industrial Revolution, people might not have had enough food, and that was the challenge, right? For most of human history, most people had a shortage of food. If they had any problems with food at all, it was that they had a shortage of food. They were hungry. And then after the Industrial Revolution, food became plentiful. No one goes hungry. No one is, you know, suffering for lack of calories. However, we are suffering from lack of nutrients. So, you know, 300 years, people had not enough food, but plenty of nutrients. And nowadays, people have plenty of food, but not enough nutrients. So it's like the problem's kind of switched there. And the reason for this is that the Industrial Revolution was very good at like automating things, and it enabled like increased efficiency and productivity, all of which are like could be good things. But the processes that were put in place, they sacrificed quality in order to get the quantity. So now, you know, nowadays or going in the future, you know, the vision of the future is that we have the technology that can enable better quantities of food or whatever it is. And we can also make it at a higher quality too. This is the cool thing. Like if you were like hanging out in where I live near New York, you know, maybe 200 years ago before the Industrial Revolution, you were very limited in the amount, like the types of foods you could eat. There was no olive oil. There was no caviar. There were no fish eggs. There was no like fresh seafood. You know, maybe you had your organ meats, certainly. But the range, there's no fresh fruits, you know, there's no frozen like organic raspberries. You were very limited in the amounts of food that you, the amounts of quality food that you could obtain. Like if you eat right today, your diet is better than like basically anyone of in all of human history, just due to the nature of our supply chains and like what you can physically access. The problem is that like most people don't have that kind of diet. And, you know, there may be issues about whether or not the food system as currently structured could support it. I'm certain it could be changed to accommodate it, but it could certainly support it. So yeah, it's like this, it's this classic quality versus quantity trade-off, specifically things that happened in the Industrial Revolution, like preservatives, basically chemical preservatives were invented. Although there had been preservatives in years prior, for example, salt is an excellent preservative of meats and various vegetables. Fermentation is a good way of preserving things, but the chemical preservatives made stuff easier. Another thing
is, and cheaper as well, which is one of the drivers for this.
Cheaper. So like a lot of the innovations of the Industrial Revolution weren't strictly necessary, if that makes sense. They just made certain things easier. For example, like there was no refrigeration before the Industrial Revolution. So what did you do? If you had too much milk, you turned it into cheese. But cheese making takes a while. It's expensive and whatever. So it's a lot easier to be able to just pasteurize and refrigerate something so milk can last on the shelf for, you know, a month. You can, if you get ultra high temp pasteurized milk at the like conventional grocery store, like the expiration date will be like a month or 2 months out, right? It's easier and cheaper than having to go get fresh raw milk from your neighbor's cow down the street, you know? But it's not as if pre-industrial life didn't have answers to these problems. They did. They just those answers were a bit more difficult and more costly. And so that's where we end up here. Another thing.
And a bit more seasonal as well, Stephen, yeah. too. So you were mentioning organic frozen raspberries, I think it was, yeah. you said. So they'd be coming from a state or a country that was producing those yeah. at a time of year when the area outside New York wasn't or never.
Yeah, so where I live, raspberries are actually somewhat, I'm not necessarily, I don't know enough to say they're native, but they are produced locally. Growing up, I had a raspberry bushes in my backyard in the woods. And in August and September, guess what? Raspberry season. And you go out and you eat your raspberries. And then 2 weeks later, guess what? No more raspberries. So if you wanted to have raspberries outside of that 3 week period or something, you'd have to turn them into jam or jelly, or that's it. There's nothing else. There's no, freezing as a method of preservation, for example. But turning stuff into jam or jelly is hard. It's a lot harder than freezing. Another thing is the pesticides and fertilizers, the way farming works, the plows and stuff. So because harvesting used to be done largely by hand, it limited the amount of land you could physically harvest. And so the plots were smaller and farms were more integrated. For example, a farm in New England, 200 or 300 years ago, they might've had cows and pigs and chickens, and they would have grown wheat and garlic and probably potatoes as well. They might've grown corn. They would have had apple trees, that was on one farm. And so every single farm would have a similar diversity of produce available. And each farm was relatively small. But what's happened, thanks to inventions like the plow and other pieces of equipment that make harvesting and planting, more easy and efficient, is that you end up with these expansive cornfields, these expansive soy fields that having other things in the field would make it harder. You see those long rows of crops. The reason crops are done that way is so that plows and tractors can better plant and harvest and maintain them.
It's an efficiency measure.
It's not because that's the ideal method of farming. It's because that is the thing that's most compatible with our machinery. And so a well-integrated, organic, some might call it a biodynamic or regenerative farm 200 years ago would have had, the farmers would have had a lot more tools available to them to deal with pesticide or, to deal with pests or to deal with droughts or whatever else. Just an obvious example, if you want to have a vegetable garden and you don't want to use pesticides, well, how do you keep the bugs out, right? So you can use natural pesticides, for example, tobacco juice. If you brew a tea basically with tobacco in it, and spray that on stuff, that'll kill bugs without necessarily being harmful to humans. So maybe that works. But another obvious thing is that chickens and ducks in your vegetable garden will eat the bugs. That's what they're designed to do. Chickens and birds in general eat insects, and they're very good at it. And so if you have your chickens and your ducks running around your vegetable garden, instead of having aphids go and kill all your strawberries, well, the ducks would get to the aphids first. However, nowadays, that's illegal, because the FDA exists or the USDA exists and says that you can't have your poultry in the same place as your vegetables, because if the poultry poop, a molecule of poultry poop could get on a strawberry. Is that going to kill you? Most likely not. That's how nature works. Fertilizer is animal poop, more or less. But the problem is that's the USDA rules. And so because now farmers don't have access to the pretty awesome power of it's free. It's a duck. And not only do they kill the pests on your strawberry patch, then they give you eggs, in particular, very high quality eggs, because they're eating bugs and stuff. So now not only do you not get your high quality duck eggs, you also have to spray chemical poisons from Monsanto on your crops. So there's a whole bunch of things that happen that are completely upside down, that, result in the fact that food is both devoid of the good things that it should contain, such as, nutrients, more or less. And it has too much of stuff that it shouldn't have. And why is that important? Because all disease, if you want to really break it down, is caused by two things: too much bad stuff and not enough good stuff. That's it. Not enough nutrients, too many toxins. And that's what the food also has. Too many toxins, not enough nutrients. So yeah, basically you ripped out all the quality elements of food during the Industrial Revolution and added in a whole bunch of like toxic chemical crap. And now we're dealing with the consequences.
And in aid of producing in such high volumes, that's why these methods are favored, because it produces more of particular products and particular foodstuffs, which of course leads to more revenue and potentially more profit, yeah, because those options are more profitable for the large companies that produce it. I can see that entirely.
The human like labor is always the most expensive part of any business. And all you need to know about this is that in like 1900, about 95% of people in like the West farmed. 95% of people were farmers. And now it's like the opposite. Barely 5%, I think it's 3% of Americans are farmers today. So 92% of the entire population no longer needs to get a paycheck in order to produce food. And so all of the cost of that labor is now taken out of the food system. And so that's how so you got cheap food. In the 1950s, people spent 30% of their household income on food. 30%, a third of their entire disposable income was spent on groceries for their family only 70 years ago. And now in America, it's about 11%.
I find that's remarkable, because as you say, the quality of what people are eating has fallen much lower as well. And we've not specifically named any particular food yet, but you're talking about processed foods in general, aren't you, in terms of like hyper palatable, high calorie dense things that have been produced in a way that is out of alignment with ancestral foods or foods that we had access to. So for that to be cheaper, of course, but there that comes at a price in terms of health, yes, potentially, and a kind of adding fuel to the fire of our sedentary lifestyle where we aren't farming or aren't active in our day jobs.
Yeah, nothing, you don't get anything for free. You never get anything for free. And so the idea that we can have cheap food while also maintaining quality is just like insane. That being said, there are plenty of ways that technology can help make the production and distribution of quality food more efficient. For example, refrigeration and freezing is an excellent tool because, like I said, you can freeze berries and eat them all year round. You can refrigerate milk. A big issue, like one of the reasons why raw milk stopped becoming a thing, or one of the reasons why raw milk was banned and pasteurization became a thing, is because it happened before the invention of refrigeration. And so you had these warehouses in city outskirts, like in Brooklyn, where they would keep all the cows and feed them literal garbage and whatever else they get their hands on inside of dingy warehouses in the middle of a city. And those cows would produce milk, and that milk was toxic and it killed a bunch of people. And so they said, hey, we should pasteurize this. If, on the other hand, refrigeration had been invented first, what would have happened is that we would have just kept the cows out in the countryside where they belong. They would have produced very high quality milk, raw milk, wouldn't have needed pasteurization. And then they would have just gone on refrigerated, you know, trucks or trains into the cities where it would be available for sale by the people who lived in cities. So like the very fact that we have refrigeration invalidates the need for pasteurizing of dairy products. But that's not the way that history played out. And so now, even though we have refrigeration, we also have pasteurization too. So like that's one very good example of how technology can help food, you know, production without decreasing quality. Another example is just my business itself, like masa chips could be made in front of a campfire if I really wanted to, with no electricity, like, you know, a giant cast iron cauldron. I could go kill a cow, render its fat, make the tallow, get some corn. You know, we can literally do that. And that's kind of how you know that it's not a processed food. Like if your food item could be made end to end without electricity or supply chains that are enabled by electricity, then you know that you have a real food. But the point is, I don't have to actually do that. I can have giant stainless steel fryers with like natural gas burners, and it's like all, you know, electronic temperature controlled systems and like very like sophisticated filtration mechanisms and all these things that enable me to make the same physical thing with a lot less labor and a lot easier, which is awesome because you get the quality, but you get some efficiency benefits too.
Absolutely. And with these processed foods, so since the Industrial Revolution, the massive increase in these, the fact that they're cheaper and easier to access, so that people's grocery spend for their household makes up a small percentage of their income. But if you looked at the caloric intake as part of that, it would probably be a lot higher. Plus their caloric output from their activity and their lifestyle is probably lower too. So it's that kind of deadly balance of the two. What is it about these processed foods that is likely to be making people more obese and more unhealthy?
Yes, good question. So there are a few things that like contribute to obesity. Obviously, one of them is just the quantity of calories consumed, certainly. And the other thing is the quantity of calories burned. Everyone knows it's like calories in, calories out thing. That's like sort of right. But the problem with calories in, calories out is that the reality is way more complicated than people make it out to be. Namely, because the amount of calories that you burn is highly, highly variable on like a billion different factors. Hormones, you know, the food that you eat itself, your physical activity, where you live, what your DNA says, all of these things, like the time of the year, the time of the day, all of these things affect how many calories you burn. And so this is called metabolism, right? And one of the best ways to measure your metabolic functioning is by your body temperature, your basal body temperature, right? This is like, without you doing anything, without you walking up the stairs or running on a treadmill, without you doing anything, how many calories does your body burn? And that can be measured by how much heat your body produces. Something that I learned very recently is that our average body temperature is about 1.5 degrees lower than it used to be. So everyone knows this idea, like 98.6 degrees. I don't know what it is in Celsius, but like your body temperature is supposed to be 98.6 degrees. Well, that was when people figured out what body temperature was supposed to be 100 years ago. Nowadays, average body temperatures are like 97.5 degrees or something. And that sounds like a minimal difference. It's only like a little over a degree. But hypothermia is considered a body temperature below 95 degrees. So like we're about 30% closer to just walking around with hypothermia on average than we were 100 years ago. So that's a huge drop in metabolism. Like if you think about your like the body temperature itself is like the result of the furnace of your body burning food and producing heat. Like that's significantly lower energy consumption. And that's a problem because if we eat the same amount of calories and we burn fewer calories, then we store more calories as fat. And it's further a problem, not just for obesity, but like your brain, you know, the complexity of the human brain is enabled by our ability to burn a lot of calories. Like we evolved such a complex brain because we had access to an abundance of like nutrition and calories that other animals might not have had. And by having slower metabolisms across the board, like one can only imagine the implications for like everyone's IQ and just like how they can think, you know? And also, so the brain is the biggest consumer of calories in your body. It's the single most energy intensive organ. And so if that, you know, production of your brain's output is reduced 30% or whatever, like, dude, we're just walking around like dumb. Like that sucks.
Yeah. Functioning at a lower level, the link between the gut and the brain absolutely fascinates me. And I hosted a Scottish gut health, modern medicine entrepreneur called Dr. James McElroy. And he was talking about the link between the gut and the brain and how there's been studies where the healthy gut microbiome of a mouse has been put into the gut microbiome of an unhealthy mouse. And that mouse has used calories more effectively when it's had its gut microbiome basically put to a correct level. And that will undoubtedly, not all studies from mice extrapolate out to humans, of course. We've got lots of different challenges with that. But that undoubtedly gives an indication that many people in the modern world's gut microbiome is compromised. Mm-hmm. And it probably is linking to their ability to regulate hunger, to know what to eat, to know what to consume, to manage their brain function as well. And a lot of mental health and some of the disorders that we're seeing a massive rise in, there's probably quite a good case that is linked to the fact that the gut microbiome has been compromised too. Yeah. And that has come from, of course, the food that we eat, but also the environmental toxins that we're exposed to, such as pollution, microplastics.
Yeah, so if we go back to the whole metabolism thing, your brain is the largest consumer of calories in your body. Like your digestion is more or less the second largest consumer of calories. It's actually strange. People think, oh, if you ask a normal person, hey, you need to go burn like 20 calories. What are you going to go do? They'll be like, oh, let me go run on a treadmill. Like, physical movement is a surprisingly poor way to burn calories, actually. The best way to burn calories is to use your brain more, because your brain is like, that organ consumes way more than your biceps, like doing a bench press, which makes sense. If you think about other animals, every animal can do a freaking bicep curl. Every animal can go lift something. Very few animals can go paint the Sistine Chapel, or actually zero animals. Very few humans can paint the Sistine Chapel, but you get my point. No other animals can do math or like do philosophy. Or read a book or something. So it makes sense to think that like all that complexity, like there's a relationship between energy and that and the achieving that complexity. So the brain burns the largest amount of calories. The second largest calorie consuming organ is your digestion itself. And so if your digestion is messed up, then like that throws this whole thing out of whack too. And so a lot of people who are constipated or whatever, what do they have? They have sluggish digestion. Why? Because their metabolism is low, and so there's not enough energy available in their gut to process their food adequately. And if your food isn't processed adequately, in addition to like the overall state of toxicity in your body, guess what? Anything that your body can't just easily like metabolize correctly, it's going to store as more fat. It's like, oh, I don't have the time to deal with all these calories you just gave me. I don't have the energy. Your metabolism is too slow. I'll deal with it later, and later never comes unless you change something about your life. And what that looks like is it's getting stored as fat. So obviously there's a lot of things that affect the gut microbiome, but what you eat is certainly an obvious thing there. And so if you have foods that damage your gut microbiome, and they also like mess with your hormones that regulate things like your metabolism and the relationship between your brain and your gut, and they, you know, hormones also moderate, you know, obesity. Namely, I'm talking about estrogen, and some people may have been able to pick up on this. If you have an abundance of hormones, namely estrogen, that like encourage all these like bad things to happen, then that's what you end up getting. And so if we go look at what foods people are eating, then, you know, it's easy to like find causes for all these things. Pesticides in grains in particular that everyone eats are very damaging to the gut microbiome. Glyphosate by Monsanto, also known as Roundup, which is sprayed on all the corn and all the wheat and all the soy, that stuff, it doesn't actually kill like mammals. That's kind of the whole point of it. It was invented to kill like non-mammalian life. And the problem is, if it's in your gut microbiome is filled with bacteria that are susceptible to it. So that's if 20 to 30% of people's calories come from like grains, corn, soy, and wheat, that are growing these pesticides, that's a ton of dose of this pesticide in your body every single day. So pesticides are a big thing that like contributed to all these problems. The other big thing is, of course, seed oils, which constitute another 20% of all caloric intake. And in addition to being grown with like where the seeds themselves are grown with the same pesticides that anything else is grown with, you also have the negative effects of the, you know, fatty acids in them themselves. Seed oils are estrogenic, so that will, you know, encourage your or decrease your metabolism. So you have that dimension too. But you also have seed oils. One of the effects of seed oils is that they don't make you full. Unlike tallow or butter, where if you eat it, your body's like, oh, I just ate fat. Fat is super calorie dense. I'm going to go be full now. Your body sees seed oils and they're like, it's kind of foreign because it's not a natural thing to our diet. Seed oils are like, well, what the hell is this? I don't know. Let's eat more of it. And so seed oils literally don't make you full. So you'll eat more calories of them. And then because the estrogen thing, like, and because of the fact that they are inherently stressful, inflammatory, and stress and inflammation also decrease your metabolism. Then you get this whole thing where not only are you eating more calories of seed oils, your body is burning fewer calories because your metabolism is inhibited by like the hormonal effects and the inflammatory effects of seed oils. So that's like, we accounted for basically 50% of people's calories between the grains and the seed oils. And then if you want to look at the meat, the hormones in the meat, also most animals are fed seed oils and similar, or the seeds themselves are fed soy and all this shit.
To make them
You're eating all this stuff through the animals themselves. And then everything else you eat has like chemical additives, like, I don't know, stevia, like lowers testosterone, even though it's like one of these fake sugar things, aspartame. It makes you go blind. It's got like methanol in it, and it will make you go blind and give you seizures. All of these like chemistry lab ingredients that make up a relatively small percentage of food, all of those add up. and all of that toxicity adds up. So you add all these together, you look at, like, you know, the you add up all the labels and the ingredients of, like, what a normal person eating a standard Western diet eats. And it's like, dude, you just, like, I've been loading yourself up with toxins this entire time. And to boot, on top of that, your body doesn't even have the nutrients that it needs to deal with normal life, let alone a fully toxic life, right? Because the more toxins you're exposed to, the more nutrients your body should need in order to be able to, like, appropriately
to counterbalance. Yeah. The seed oils element fascinates me because it's not entirely new to me, but relatively new to me because I hadn't gone deep on this. Like, one of the things I've been aware of is processed versus unprocessed. So trying to have as many single ingredient foods as possible in your meals. And I come from a physique focused bodybuilding style training background where eating well was important. Caloric balance is obviously focused upon that as well. And of course, there were some health foods within that that we may well discuss that potentially can mess with your gut in a way that I definitely and many of my friends have become aware of as well in more recent times, with some of the kind of fake sugars and stuff that are within those that your body can't really tolerate. But the seed oils element, when I started to go deep on this a lot through your content as well, it's how prevalent it is within the system that is surprising, because if your body isn't fantastic at utilizing it, it surprises me, or it should surprise somebody who is health conscious, how prevalent it is within the system in terms of the amount it's used to process the day-to-day foods that we have.
Yeah, seed oils are the most shocking food that people eat for a number of reasons, not least of which is what you mentioned, which is that, like, in an ingredient label on any food or whatever, the standard diet, what people eat in a week or whatever, seed oils are the single largest, like, quantity of food that's fake, like, by an order of magnitude, right? Even though the rice or the corn or the soy or the wheat is grown with pesticides, at least those things, like, are kind of food, right? You grow them, you put them in food, and then you eat them. Like, they come from the farm. It's still food, even if they might not be the best food items. All the little additives, like the sugars and the preservatives and the colorings and the whatever, like, while toxic and from a chemistry lab, they make up a very small percentage of the overall mass of, like, food that people eat. But seed oils are literally 20% of people's calories. Like, 1/5 of all the food that you eat is seed oils. It's, like, the single largest category of fake food that people are eating. And the thing is, you mentioned processed food and whatnot. Processed food is almost synonymous with seed oils. Processed food didn't really exist until seed oils existed, or until seed oils were invented. Before seed oils, there were no packaged foods or fast food or junk food. That entire category of things that people eat that everyone knows is bad for us, that entire category of things is predicated on seed oils being the primary fat source in that food item. Whether it's,
can we name some of the seed oils that are the most common?
So seed oils refers to oils that are industrially extracted from a number of crops' seeds. So, for example, soybean oil is the oil that comes from soybeans that's industrially extracted and concentrated into a bottle of soybean oil. Corn oil is the same thing. It's not to say that you can't eat soybeans, or maybe you should eat soybeans or corn or whatever. However, it's not the crop itself. It's like the extracted concentrated oils that go through this industrial chemical processing and whatnot that we're really talking about here. And so you can find seed oils from soybean oil, corn oil, peanut oil, sunflower oil, safflower oil, grape seed oil, rape seed oil, which is actually like the sort of European name for canola oil. Canola oil, if you're in America or Canada, rice bran oil. And I think there are one or two others, but I'm pretty sure those are the common ones. So yeah, if you find any labels of food, of packaged food, anywhere in the West, and most places that are outside of the West too, even the healthy foods, you will find seed oils. They are everywhere. And it's like this one thing that's like, it's like, I don't know, water is in almost every freaking recipe that exists, right? In some form or another. Seed oils are like water in food. They're that ubiquitous, and no one's paid any attention to them for, like, you know, 40, 50 years. And they are incredibly toxic. And yeah, it's actually quite shocking how big of a deal this is and how long it's sort of like they were kind of under the radar there.
One of the big things that I've started to understand is it's to do with the different types of fats within the oils as well. So you mentioned earlier, olive oil, tallow. Did you mention lard?
I have not talked about lard, but yeah, lard is similar to tallow.
Okay. So those were ones that you held up because my understanding is that those are typically monosaturated, yeah. Whereas with seed oil, they're typically polyunsaturated, yeah. Which is something that our bodies haven't really learned to adapt to yet and potentially toxic, as you were saying.
So seed oils are mostly full of polyunsaturated fats. Polyunsaturated fats are the problem fats. That polyunsaturated fats are the reason for all of seed oil's detrimental effects, the primary reason, at least, for all their detrimental effects. Polyunsaturated fats are very prone to oxidation. They will break apart into inflammatory molecules, like just spontaneously in air, oxygen, light, or heat will cause that to happen. So yeah, they are to be avoided. Monounsaturated fats are, there's just the fat molecule has one unsaturated. It means there's one double bond in the chain of carbons. Monounsaturated fats are present in fats like olive oil and avocado oil, and are predominant in those types of fats. And they are not really a problem because those bonds are more stable. It's still not ideal for, you know, things like high temperature cooking and whatnot, but they've also been around for a long time and people have been eating them and they're fine. So and the crazy thing is that like where you get these oils from, the processing changes dramatically. If you want olive oil, you just squeeze an olive and olive oil comes out. But if you want seed oils, you need like an entire, you know, assembly line of machinery to get the oil out. Anyway, so that's monounsaturated fats. And then the last category of fats that are relevant is saturated fats. And these are present in the fats that are solid at room temperature, like butter, tallow, lard, bacon grease. And those are the most stable and the best suited to high temperature cooking. And so you have the three categories, saturated, monounsaturated, and polyunsaturated. Polyunsaturated are the worst. Most people probably agree that saturated are the best. And seed oils are full of polyunsaturated fats and they are in everything. While at the same time, people, you know, we used to use saturated fats for everything. Everyone thinks those are like kind of gross and like weird nowadays, thanks to some very clever and well-funded propaganda from like the seed oil companies over the 20th century. But yeah, that's the lay of the fat land right there.
When it comes to that, somebody that's kind of well known in the health and wellness space, like Andrew Huberman, was talking about the fact that a lot of the time it seems to be the devil's in the dosage. But you would go further than that and say that consumption at all is the
biggest challenge. Well, I think that's generally true. The problem is that any like consumption of seed oils is inherently high dose polyunsaturated fats. So, like take tallow for example. It is one of the more saturated fats out there, about 50% saturated, it's around 45% monounsaturated and 5% polyunsaturated. It is, you know, but that's a small dose relative to, you know, the whole composition of fat. You're getting a tiny amount of polyunsaturated fats. And guess what? Humans have been eating cows and animal fat for millennia and we're fine. So it's like, that's where you're going to get anything that you actually need. You're going to get it by eating real foods like that. Even olive oil has a small percentage of polyunsaturated fats. You'll get it from olive oil. However, seed oils are just like they are inherently high dose because of the way they're concentrated from the seeds themselves. Basically, like if you were to eat like an ear of corn, that would be equivalent to like, I don't know, a microscopic amount of corn oil. It takes like ears and ears and ears of corn to get you a tablespoon of corn oil. It takes you like bushels of soybeans to get you a tablespoon of soybean oil. So due to the nature of their processing, they already come out concentrated and inherently high dose. Obviously, of course, if you're going to eat, you know, seed oil fried foods once a week and nothing else, that's better than the standard way people are eating. But any amount of seed oils is detrimental.
And the alternatives that you would hold up would be traditional fats like tallow, like
butter, lard, and olive oil, pretty much. Okay. The thing to keep in mind about animal fats, like especially from pigs and chickens, is that if the pigs and chickens are fed a very poor diet or in particular a diet full of polyunsaturated fats, then the fats that they eat end up in their body fat. And so like a soybean-fed chicken has fat with a higher content of polyunsaturated fats than like a pasture-raised chicken would. So you got to be careful with the quality for those animal fats. But cows are a bit different. Like most cow products, even if they're industrial warehouse, whatever, cows, not ideal, of course, but they're going to be less detrimental than the types of animal products from like chickens and pigs that are raised in a similar setting.
Given your passion for this area and educating on it, of course, we've spoken about you kind of moving towards creating Ancient Crunch and Massa. What was the tipping point that allowed you to go from your highly paid tech job, albeit that was not working you particularly hard during COVID or C19, whatever you want to call it? What was the kind of tipping point that allowed you to go all in on this mission and this passion?
I quit my job on September 2nd of last year, and we sold our first bag of Massa chips on July 21st. So there was about 6 weeks from when we first sold to when I quit my job. And I think that the thing that caused me to do that was just the fact that it was succeeding. So we sold chips. We made a batch, you know, in our test kitchen. It sold out in like a few hours, and then we kept doing that for a few more weeks. And then before you knew it, I was like, during the weekdays, I was out of the kitchen with my like work phone, like pretending to answer messages from my boss if I got anything, like while my team was like cooking chips in the fryer, and I was like making sure that all the packaging was happening correctly. And then after a week or two of that, I was like, this can't work. If Massa is going to work, I have to spend all my time on it. So that's when I quit my job.
You want to go all in. That makes total sense. And I think given the passion you've got for the movement, but also you kind of bringing a solution to the market, it would be detrimental to spread any of that energy.
Yeah, exactly. Like the opportunity cost is just way too high, right? Like every week of being employed as a software engineer, I would make, what would that be? Let me do some quick math here, just for the sake of argument. I would make like $5,000 a week, basically, being a software engineer. And so it's like, oh, that's a lot of money. But the opportunity cost is way more than $5,000, right? Because like when Massa is successful and like operating at full scale, my weeks are going to be way more valuable than 5K, even in like net present value terms or whatever you want to call it. That was very clear to me. That was the path out, because I don't want to be a software engineer for big tech or whatever. That was never really my intention. And so this was the most compelling alternative that I had ever stumbled into. And so it ended up being a pretty like easy decision for me.
What are the biggest challenges you face within Massa?
I think our biggest issue right now is production, right? How to make more chips, because we make all of our chips ourselves up to date by hand. And, you know, getting away from the by hand thing is definitely a big goal, because this is what goes back to what I was saying before about technology. Like, we can use technology to make more chips without changing anything about the ingredients of the recipe or adding any chemicals or whatnot. The thing is, in order to automate stuff, you need to spend money on machinery, and machinery is expensive. And so how do you manage the money around all that is like a challenge. And then, of course, even if you identify the machinery and then decide to purchase it, like most industrial equipment is on like a 6-month lead time nowadays. So like we're actually about to do this, I'm about to go get like a big new frying line. We're getting, you know, quotes around or whatever. And if I were to place the order this week, I wouldn't have it installed and running until April. And it's October for, you know, for posterity. It's the second day of October. So that is, yeah, making enough chips is hard. And the reason why it's uniquely hard for us is because most food brands that exist out there, they don't manufacture their own products. No one really knows this somehow. No one knows this, but the very small minority of food brands that like you might consume on a daily basis are manufactured in-house by the people who are also doing the selling. And it's the proportion of people who are self-manufacturing is a bit higher among obviously the healthy quality like food space, but it's still very tiny. And there are many reasons for that. And that's generally like the advisable way to start a business. But for us, that was never even an option because none of the food manufacturers that do like, this is called contract manufacturing or co-manufacturing. They're basically giant factories that make everyone's products and slap their, whoever their client's label on it. The people who do contract manufacturing are unable to make masa at the quality spec that we need. They don't want to deal with my tallow. They don't want to like make sure everything's clean in the right ways and have all the organic corn and whatever else, the filtered water and everything else that we need. So the only real way for us to do it is to make it ourselves. And yeah, growing manufacturing while trying to also grow revenue, you know, that's marketing, is a very difficult thing that not many businesses, especially in food, really ever do, at least in the modern day.
Again, and based on the food system, it's not as if there's maybe a really easy blueprint for you to follow either.
No, I mean, we are the only people like frying carbs and animal fat at scale. Like, I'm not going to say on Earth because I've never been to every country, but like certainly in the U.S. and obviously our scale is small still, but it will get a lot bigger, and then we will truly be the only ones doing it at like large scale. There's no one else doing this. And it's just like, we talk to like every single co-manufacturer. That's what they're called. Co-mans, co-manufacturer. We talk to every single one of them in the country that could possibly make chips and no one can do it. You know, this like we're building something that doesn't exist, which is crazy to me too. Cause like we actually are not inventing anything. Nothing that I'm doing is innovative in any way.
If anything, you're stripping back from the process because there's less
involved. I'm doing like an antiquated manufacturing process, right? Like 80 years ago, this might be how things are made. But today, no one is making things in this way, which is like makes it even like crazier to me, the fact that like this is so difficult. Like I'll talk to these people whose entire job in life is like they own a tortilla chip company that makes tortilla. They own a tortilla chip factory that makes tortilla chips for like a million different brands. And they, you know, have their cooking oils and they have their corn and all this stuff. They don't know what tallow is. I'm like, can you fry in tallow? And they're like, what's tallow? Literally, like, which it's so wild that like before, you know, 80 years ago, that's all there was to fry in, tallow and lard. And nowadays, no one even knows what it is. Like, how quickly does like history get erased or culture get erased? It's kind of crazy. So yeah, I'd say that's our primary challenge. And then the second challenge is the fact that like our product is expensive, and rightfully so in my, you know, opinion, because we wouldn't be able to grow if we didn't, you know, actually charge money that enabled that to happen. So yeah, we can make it cheaper and then we would be small forever. And then, you know, I wouldn't be able to create the world in where everyone has access to like foods that aren't poison. But because they're expensive, people like to complain about that. And so figuring out how to do branding and marketing and positioning in a way that like, you know, sort of justifies that price and results in fewer people complaining about it, or at least finding the people who won't complain about it, at least for the time being, that is, I would say, the second biggest challenge. And
if people are heavily enough invested in their health and eating in a way that is in alignment with ancestral principles and seed oil deniers, yeah, or whatever the term would be online, then they would be much more willing to pay that little bit extra for crisps or chips, because that is the juice is worth the squeeze in, because they're getting access to a food that they like the taste and texture of. But if they were to have the more readily available cheaper alternative, it would be against their health principles, whereas they need to pay a premium in order to get access to a product that's made in alignment with their values.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me. The math checks out, but like modern people, no offense to them, especially like older people, are very spoiled, right? They spend 11% of their disposable income on food, right? Their great grandparents spent 30% of their disposable income on food. These people are walking around with like a supercomputer in their pocket. They have like a digital portal into another dimension known as a TV on their wall. They have like three cars, right? They can fly anywhere in the country or in the world on vacation, basically whenever they want. And they don't have to work on a farm for 8 hours a day, right? And they spend a third of the money that their great or their grandparents or their great grandparents spent on groceries, and they think food is too expensive. Like that really, like, I understand there are some people out there today who genuinely do not have money to be able to afford good food. Maybe it's like the poorest 25 to 30% of people. I understand that. And that is what it is. But these people are not those people, right? It's absolutely mind-blowing to me. And then the worst part about this is like, okay, fine. You just don't care about food. You'd rather have your like three cars and your boat and go do whatever the hell that you do, whatever boomers do in the US. But the worst part is that these are the same people who will complain about how terrible all the food is. Like that is, I'm sorry, like that you're just being a complete hypocrite. You know, if you don't want to spend money on food, go right ahead, buy the cheap food from Frito-Lay that's going to poison you, because that's what the point is, you know? And they'll the same people who in the same breath will be like, oh, the big food companies are evil. They're trying to poison us. They're putting like crap in the food and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you're buying it. Like,
It surprises me there's an overlap there. I think a lot of people are just blissfully ignorant.
Like, it's not like Frito-Lay is at your, like, following you around at the grocery store at gunpoint saying, like, buy Doritos or I'll shoot you, right? Not only are they choosing to do it, they're paying for the privilege. They're paying for the privilege of poisoning themselves. Like, you are making that choice and you're giving them money. And then they'll say, oh, big food is, they have so much lobbying power and they spread their propaganda, which is exactly what happened, right? Procter & Gamble, the company that invented seed oils, they donated $24 million to the American Heart Association in 1922 or whatever it was to promote polyunsaturated fats and promote seed oils and to denigrate saturated fats. And so people be like, look at things like that or like lobbying and Monsanto and whatnot and be like, these companies have so much money. They're like, out, they're evil. They're out to get us. And it's like, you think like they're getting like money from the government? They're getting, well, some are getting subsidies, but that's not the most of it. Like Frito-Lay or Monsanto has money because you pay for it. You literally gave them your money willingly, voluntarily, and consensually. And now you're complaining that they have money. You know, like that.
This does link into your personal agency point to start, doesn't it? Where a lot of people are responsible. They just need to, one, have the information and two, act in alignment with that information if they choose to do so.
Yeah. I mean, and there are plenty of people that are like that and they get it. And like, that's great. And they're our supporters and they're awesome and we love them. The people that are very vocal about all this stuff are like the ones that really annoy me. And then the other thing too about food, just like while we're on the subject of money, is like, yeah, good food costs money. And at least in the US where like healthcare is not free, you know what costs more money? You being sick. And not only what costs more money, how about the fact that you're sick? Like, I don't care. Even if I had free healthcare, I don't want to be sick. People care about their bodies so little that they would literally rather be sick. Even if being sick were free, they would rather be sick than like spend appropriate amount of money to feel good. And it's like, I can't help you. If that's your situation, I can't help you.
It's a really unusual paradigm, isn't it?
It's not a small number of people. Like many people believe this way. And I honestly think it's harder to get people to care about their health in Europe because they'll be like, oh, whatever. I go to the doctor, it's free. Because if they just don't care about their bodies to that extent, like, sure. Okay. They might, you know, be like, at least it doesn't cost me money. I'll be sick, whatever. But in America, it really blows my mind. And especially it's like the same boomers that like in the last 3 years of their life will spend $3 million on cancer treatment and like chemo and radiation and all these therapies just to like die a slow, painful and undignified death at the end of it. That's the same people. So it's really quite a shame. But there's definitely people that understand it and, you know, there are supporters and they're going to like enable us to grow. And then in 5 years when Ancient Crunch is like half as big as Frito-Lay, or 10 years when we're as half as big as Frito-Lay and we're able to like charge lower prices, then those people will, I'm sure, you know, begrudgingly buy more.
They'll feel they've got better access. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And in terms of a couple of final questions for you, Stephen, then you mentioned 5 and 10 years then. What is the vision for Ancient Crunch in those years?
Basically, we're going to become the Frito-Lay of real food. That's the easiest way to describe it. So Frito-Lay has a portfolio of crunchy, delicious carbs that everyone loves that happen to be poison. And so we're going to make crunchy, delicious carbs that everyone loves that happen to not be poison. And we're going to make it, not only we're going to sell the food, we're going to brand it and like create a, you know, a movement and a lifestyle around this that's like very, you know, broadly appealing and like generally cool, if you will. So beyond tortilla chips, you know, you could use your imagination and figure out what else we might be interested in making. But yeah, the Ancient Crunch Pantry, like that's what it's going to be. It's no longer like basically turning junk food into not junk.
Tasty, tasty, palatable, enjoyable food that meets the health standards that you set out.
That's like, it's just, and it's not even like my opinion, it's just real, right? It's like, there's just nothing fake. No other tortilla chip that I know of can say this, or no other chip that I know of can say this, right? Everything's got, even avocado oil is basically fake. Like that was invented like 20 years ago. No, avocado oil is not like a traditional culinary staple of like Mesoamerica. Like that's ridiculous. Or palm oil too. There's a brand that uses palm oil, which is technically not a seed oil, but also like you have to deforest half of Indonesia in order to create palm oil. But then people will say there's sustainable palm oil. And it's like, if you're like shipping giant tankers full of oil that you extract from this fruit in Indonesia across the Pacific Ocean, and then, you know, trucking it around to factories in the, like, how is that sustainable?
It's probably not very green friendly. No. Yeah, it's funny when you lift the lid on a lot of these things, and avocados is held up as a funny example when people who maybe have a vegan diet do it for ethical reasons. They quite often get criticized for that, and potentially rightly so. But Stephen, I've learned an awful lot during this conversation, things that I need to go away and consider further in terms of my own intake, and many of the listeners will have done as well. And I think the mission and the passion that you've got for what you're driving towards is really inspiring to hear. And I love the fact that you've been able to go all in from a really well-paid job to chase the dream, and it's giving you that positive feedback already in terms of the ability to go full-time in it and grow over the last year or so. If people want to continue the conversation with you, where should they head towards?
You can find me on social media at Really Tan Man. That's most likely going to be Twitter, Instagram. And if you want to try Masa Chips, you can do so at masachips.com, masachips.com.
Beautiful, Stephen. Those will be linked in the show notes. Thank you to the listener. I'll be back to speak to you all again very, awesome. Very
Thanks for having
soon.
Me.